I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
My name is Patrick Hester. His name is John Anilio, and you're listening to the Functional Nerds Podcast.
That's Patrick. He's an author. He's got a book out called Into the Fire through Wordfire Press. You can pick that up now. It's the first book in the Sam Cain stories. And I am John Anilio, and today we are delighted to be joined by Stephen Barnes. He's the New York Times best-selling Hugo Award-nominated author and screenwriter. And he also is the creator of the Life Writing writing course, which is something I would like to ask him about.
Trust me, I'll tell you. You don't have to twist my arm. Yeah. Throw me in the briar patch, please.
He's also the winner of the NAACP Image Award. He's the co-author of the Tennyson Hardwick mystery series with his spouse, Tunan Arif Du, and the actor Blair Underwood. His new novel, which is out June 27th, is called 12 Days. Stephen, thank you for being on the show today.
Oh, God. It's a joy. I'm really happy. You know, my 32nd novel or something like this. And I'm always, on some level, it's always just as nervous. If you care about something, it's always just as fragile. You know, I did the best job I could. I had good help on it. I hope people like it. So having an opportunity to talk about that or my work, my life, stuff like that, giving people an opportunity to get to know me.
You know, it really kind of heartens me to hear you say that, because as John just mentioned, I've got a debut novel out, and I was able to actually get the cover that I wanted, which is very rare. It's a cover by Galen Dara. And I was so ridiculously excited that she agreed to do it. And I asked her for a poster size print. And she did that for me and signed it and sent it to me. And I was telling an author who has a ton of books out about this and how excited I was and that I'm going to put it up on the wall. And, you know, they said, well, you know, I used to do that too. I used to be so excited about my books when they would come out. And I would do the same thing. I would get the art and I'd put it up on the wall. But after a while, it just gets old. And I went, I hope I never feel that way. I hope that this feeling sticks with me if I publish 10 books or 100 books.
Okay. It won't. However, that doesn't mean that you can love the process of your artistic life even more. But an individual symbol of a movement along that, like a book, a poster, this or that, will not have exactly the same meaning to you. You can get deeper satisfaction, deeper pleasure. And, you know, it's like the first 10 times you make love to you ever made love to your wife, it is qualitatively a different experience from the sex that happens after that. But that doesn't mean that first sex was better. It means it was more intense. It served a particular purpose to bond the two of you together. The first time you experience something, there is a bigger flair because either neurologically or just sort of existentially, if it's a positive thing, your brain and your spirit want you to know this is right, this is good, more of this. But if sex kept feeling as good as it felt in the first 10 times in that particular way, you'd never get out of bed. And you wouldn't be able to get on with your life. You wouldn't be able to take care of the children who are going to come into your life as a result of that. You wouldn't be able to go to work. In other words, it would be too distracting. So that flare, that limerence, that singing in the rain feeling of tap dancing in the rain, that serves a damned good purpose. The meaning of life is to be happy, but that extent of happiness, that intensity of happiness, has a downside. You know, the first time you get a really bad review and take it to heart, it will crush you. So I cannot let myself be as, you know, wee about individual books as I did at the beginning, because at least partially because I noticed that there would be matching depressions when things went bad. So I kind of squeeze it down. I enjoy my life hugely. I enjoy the little kid inside me is just delighted with the man that I am in that sense, despite the fact that I fail at things and been betrayed at things and, you know, fallen on my face and this and that. So what? You know, it's a super chicken world in the sense that I knew the job was dangerous when I took it. I'm happy. I'm not always ecstatic. You should be ecstatic. It is appropriate for you to be ecstatic. Stay in that. But the overall meaning of your life is to be happy and to change and grow and become more of who you are, to have the wisdom of an adult with the heart of a child. That is winning. Do that, whatever that means to you, and you've won the game.
That is awesome.
Patrick, who knew you were going to get such fantastic life and writing advice?
Good luck. I mean, and congratulations. This is a really important thing that has happened to you. I do not in the slightest underestimate, and I hope you don't. Store up these memories. You will need them later in your career, because one of these days you'll ask yourself, why am I doing this? It will be to make the little boy inside you happy. That's why you do it.
That's awesome. Thank you.
Awesome. Well, so much, you know, I was telling Stephen before the show, I really wanted to get him on the show because when I did a little research, he's done so much. He's had such, you know, he's crafted such an amazing career and life for himself in terms of all the creative things that he's done. So there's so much that I want to get into. So I want to dive in. So before we get to that, real quick, if you enjoy the show, you enjoy interviews with folks like Stephen here, consider becoming one of our backers. First of all, the people who already back us every month, thank you so much. We really appreciate it. For the people who don't back us, if you like the show, consider becoming one of our backers. It's over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. So let's get on to our picks of the week.
Picks of the week.
Stephen, what is your pick this week?
Oh, Wonder Woman. It's a game changer. You know, it's not perfect, but it is, unless perfection is a process. Okay, I could define mastery for you. Mastery is you've got the basics of your craft at the level of unconscious competence, and you've committed to that path for a lifetime. You are on the path. If you do that, you're on the path of mastery. Okay, and you're on the path of mastery as much as anybody else on the path, no matter how much better than you they may be. No matter how far and how fast you run, you're always the same distance from the horizon. So it's not a matter of perfection being there is nothing that could have gotten better. What Patty Jenkins did in Wonder Woman was perfection of a kind. There, I have never seen a larger arc of character than I saw in Wonder Woman. We know what Wonder Woman is. She's a demigod. They start her as a child. The points of discovery along the way are all motivated. They're clearly demarked. It is joyful. By the end of the film, she has the power of a demigod and the heart of a child. I've never seen anyone do that for a woman. Never. It is remarkable. And I think that we are entering into a period in human history that no previous generation could have gone into. That we literally could not do what we're doing right now because previous generations were doing the best they could in a world pre-industrial and without birth control or firearms. As soon as you've got those three things together, we don't need the false dichotomy, the false bifurcation of human beings that became so extreme. You know, men and women are two halves of the same creature, but we've played a game that we're different in some ways that we weren't quite. Women pretended to be weaker than they really were. Men pretended to be stronger and braver than they really were. And the game was never about who's on top or who's in control. Men have never been in control of this. Our genes have always been in control. And the game has always been produce the maximum number of grandchildren. Everything that you can see is about that. Produce the maximum number of grandchildren. Our ancestors did the best they could with the resources they had. But now we can do better. Now little girls don't have to pretend to be less than they are. And little boys don't have to pretend not to cry. It's good for both of us. And films like Wonder Woman, to me, are the best of what comic books can be, which is modern mythology, which is create simple images that work for children that contain something deeper about honor or faith or hope. Just like it's just storytelling. You sit around the campfire and you tell stories. This is just the IMAX 3D version of that. And it works. It's like one of the few, just like when I saw Aliens and I saw Silence of the Lambs, this was one of the first times in my life I wished I was a woman. Because had I been a woman, I would have been able to feel what was going on up there even more deeply, to know there was something happening on the screen that has not existed in our culture before. It has never no image like what you're seeing on the screen with one woman have ever existed before in that context. It is a game changer, and I hope it makes $1 zillion. I'm very proud of Patty Jenkins. She did the best action directing job of any woman ever, and I think that she came from the side of let's do the humanity. You start with the humanity and then you build up the action. Whereas male directions often do the let's do the action and then we'll add the humanity. So it's not, they're not better or worse, but they're different parts of the yin yang symbol in that particular way. And I think she did a fabulous job. And just I think that Gal Gadot, I'm telling you, man, she captures both the dewy eyed innocent vulnerability and the absolute badass of your dreams. it's not perfect. It isn't. I can't imagine anybody not saying that, okay, they could have done this, they could have done this, they could have done this. But dear God, you can't point to a movie that got more of it right in terms of this particular sense. And therefore, you know, I give it big passes on what some might consider to be its flaws. And the flaws are not, even without that historical context, I still would have given it at least a B+. With the historical context, easy A. If I was a woman, A+, game changer, all-time classic. So yeah, I just, I loved it.
Do you think they're going to screw it up with Justice League?
I think that there is a chance that DC, rather than allowing themselves to simply be what they are, they set themselves up as the anti-Marvel.
Yep.
That the problem, the advantage that Marvel had is that Stan Lee is still alive. And so therefore, even though he hasn't been able to write or create for decades, he remembers what that creative ferment was in the bullpen back in the 60s and 70s. And he can sit in a room full of people and he's still Stan the man. He still represents what Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko and Gene Colan, all these different guys, what we're trying to accomplish there. That during that period, that was just such an incredible creative ferment. With DC, the problem is that no two characters were created by the same people. There's no consistent heart. There's nothing central in that. So it's a bunch of guys who happen to live on this, who happen to belong to the same club, but they have completely different lives and they come from completely different places. So Zack Snyder is the guy who DC trusted with shepherding, their movies forward. And the problem with Zack Snyder is that he doesn't believe in heroes. He's a deconstructionist, which is why I really thought The Watchmen worked. Because it's a deconstruction of the hero character. But do I think for a second that Zack Snyder could create a heroic character? No, not even for an instant. Nothing that would survive a generation. He doesn't believe it. He's a cynic. So you create a cynical Superman or an oppressive Superman? Are you kidding? This is a demigod, who's got more power than any other being in the universe, in some ways. Not only that, but the movie version of him can even get laid. I mean, for Christ's sake, what has he got to be angsty about? He lost his parents. Boo-hoo. Who doesn't? Everybody loses everything. The point isn't whether or not you lose crap. The point is, pull up your panties and get on with life. Create a happy place for children so that they can have the kind of childhood that you got, so that they can go out into the rest of their – they've got 12 years. To be children, you've got to pack all the love in the world into those kids so they can survive another 80 years of the adult world. When Zack Snyder makes Superman angsty, what hope do the rest of us have? If you believe that a character with that power would not be happy, would not be saying, oh man, life is my oyster. I mean, really? How are the rest of us supposed to be happy? I mean, Batman, I can understand. Batman's as crazy as the Joker.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but your parents get shot in front of you when you're a kid. $1 billion worth of therapy handles that, It's ridiculous. That's one of the things that's so fun about Tony Stark in Civil War. This guy has spent over $500 million on therapy, and he's still got mommy issues.
Yeah.
T'Challa had his father die in his arms, and within a week, he's getting his shit back together. I loved it. Wakanda.
That's amazing. Well, I can't wait to see it. I haven't gone to it yet. Patrick, quick. Yeah. What's your pick, Patrick?
My pick is actually going to be a comic book. It's a different comic book. It's Atomic Robo. And if you haven't read Atomic Robo, you're missing out. This is about a sentient robot created by Nikola Tesla.
Oh.
And his adventures essentially through time. He's not a time traveler, but because he's a sentient robot, he just lives a really, really long time. And so they will write different stories set in different time periods of his life, you know, starting from the beginning and going all the way through. The most recent one that I read was The Temple of Odd, O-D. And it's essentially Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
Oh, cool.
Kind of thing where he, you know, it's like 1938 or 39 Shanghai. And he kind of gets mixed up with Nazis and Chinese freedom fighters, the Japanese, you know, all this kind of stuff is going on. And he essentially gets called in when things are a little bit too sciencey woo-woo. You know, it's like they're doing funky things with science and they're trying to mess with dark matter and quantum energy and stuff like that. And he goes in and shuts it down kind of stuff. But the whole opening sequence of this is him coming to Shanghai, meeting a kid that looks exactly like Short Round, going to the exact same club that Indy goes to where Kate Capshaw is singing the song, you know, and he goes through all those. And then it takes off to a different path, but it's just so much fun. It shows that there are, like, this is an independent comic and there are tons of independent comics out there that are doing great things that have nothing to do with superheroes and capes. So, you know, it's Atomic Robo, go check it out. There's tons of them online for free. You can go to their website and read them like daily for free.
My pick real quick is going to be, you know, I was reminded with what Steven said at the beginning of the show about what it is to be happy. And I read a lot of psychology and I'm a teacher. And so I've just been on this quest with this kind of thing. And a recent book that I read, which Steven reminded me of, is by Gretchen Rubin. It's called The Happiness Project. It came out quite a few years ago now. And It's a very simple book just on her research into happiness, and it brings up a lot of stuff that I had been reading and other things, but it's a lot of psychology, a lot of philosophy, a lot of things like, how do we get on in this world in being happy? But I think that's the important thing. Like, how
that's the core of Buddhism.
Yes.
Now, how can we be happy? You know, and I think that the answers are so simple that people don't want to believe it.
Mm. Yeah, and I think, what, you know, you reminded me of it also because you were talking about your writing, and this is something that comes up in the book. A lot of our happiness can come from doing good work, doing our creative work, and being involved. And you had mentioned that to Patrick in the beginning, that it's not necessarily the accomplishments or whether it gets good reviews or big sales or whatever. That's all nice, that stuff. But it's the work that ultimately is satisfying and helps create your happiness.
No one is promised tomorrow. You have to live every day as if it is its own gym. Mm. Then if you have lived your days appropriately, you look back over the course of years and you'll notice you've done a lot of stuff, mm-hmm. you know, and other people say, wow, you've done all this stuff. And, you know, it's like, I've got a shelf full of books. Actually, yeah, I've got a shelf full of books that a guy named Steve Barnes wrote. I didn't write them. Every book I wrote changed me. I'm not that guy anymore. You know, if I'm working out my stuff in the book, the process of working it out changed me. I'm not the person I was when I started it. So I look at the book, and it's all very interesting, but I'm already on to the next thing. That my joy is in playing with my son now, you know, loving my wife now, being good to teaching my students now, writing today's 1,000 words or 500 words, studying what I'm studying now. Yesterday is gone and tomorrow will take care of itself. You plan those things, you remember those things, but life is lived now. That's the only moment that has any power. And in this moment, I can be happy. I can literally just choose to be happy by focusing on the things in my life that are good. People always have crap happening to them. Always, always. There is no one who, you know, no matter what has happened to you in your life, there's someone who's had worse happen to them who is happier than you.
You know, so, isn't that the speech from that episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer? Isn't that exactly what she told Jonathan? She's like, when you're worried about your own crap and you're angry that no one is paying attention to you and the stuff that you're going through, it's because they're going through their own stuff too.
Well, it's absolutely, but even bigger than that, if you are complaining that other people aren't paying attention to you, that means you're paying attention to them instead of paying attention to the thing that you were supposed to be doing. Mm-hmm. Which is getting better, spending time immersed in the thing that you love. If I'm immersed in the thing that I love, how can I simultaneously be paying attention to what anybody thinks about it?
Right.
This is what it is. You want to be the best you can be at the thing. You want to get the attention. You have to not care about the attention. Because if you care about the attention, you're not focusing on the thing. You know, it's that paradox is so central to the question of how can we be excellent at the thing that we love so that we can spend as much possible, as time possible, doing the thing that we love so that we can make the money that then represents people thinking what we're doing of value but also creates the safety to do the thing because nothing works like money in the arenas in which money works in the adult world. You can't, you know, you can't pay your light bill with back rubs. You know, so
and believe me, I've tried.
you have to live in the adult world but make the adult world safe for that little child inside you who started the journey of your life. If that kid is playing, it's not noticing whether people love them or not. You have to pay some attention to that because you don't want to go off the rails. I think in art, if art is self-expression, craft is the language of your specific arena that you are expressing art in. It's like if you're a potter, you know, there's technique. If you're a martial artist, there is technique. If you're a singer, there is technique. If you're a dancer, there's technique. And you have to learn those symbols so that the people in the audience who listen to it or see it or hear it or feel it can get the emotion that you are trying to communicate. And that's what successful art is. Somebody on the other side feels it. Now, if you want to make money, you have to step out of the question of art and into the question of marketing and sales, because that's how money is made. Money isn't made by being good at something, you know, good at your art. Money is made by being good at marketing and selling your art. And if you're not going to do it, you have to partner with somebody who will. And if you look down on marketing and sales, what are you saying to your agent, your lawyer, your publishers? You're saying, I'm above that. You know, you guys are scum. But I will allow you to take some of my money, you know, because I'm just this artist up here on the hill. And no wonder there's this antagonism between art and business. But the fact is that business is just hunting and gathering. And why do you do that? To take care of your children. Your child, in this particular sense, is your artistic sense. The part of you that looked out at the world and said, you know, earth below, heaven above, no one in the world like me. That little Buddha baby sense. And if you want to keep that alive, you got to grow up.
I think it's fantastic that you mentioned marketing because Patrick is a marketer for his day job.
Patrick, good on you. You will do well in your writing because you understand that it's a business and your publishers will enjoy working with someone who has that understanding. You know, just separate your little boy from your adult, because for the child part of you, marketing is like selling kisses.
Yeah.
You don't put your little kid out on the street turning tricks. You take care of business and you keep your child safe. You keep your heart safe.
Now, Stephen, you mentioned martial arts, and you have quite a background in martial arts. You have black belts in various forms of karate and judo and all sorts of stuff. So can you please take us back to when you got involved with martial arts? And yeah, obviously it's been something that you've been doing your whole life.
I used to get my ass kicked, you know, with regularity. And I can tell you the day I decided that this was going to be a part of my life. I was in junior high school. And there was a kid named Rudy Chavelle who had, like, bullied me since elementary school. I mean, this kid pulled a pair of brass knucks out on me when I was in, like, third grade. He took my lunch. And he got it into his head that I had narked on him, in which I had not. and that he was going to kick my ass after school. And after school that day, I'm walking home, and he and his brother Oliver and a couple of their friends came and started beating on me. And I was scared of Rudy. You know, I was this little pot-bellied, four-eyed nerd, you know, and I was terrified. But I was getting hit, and he was screaming and cursing at me and spitting in my face. And, you know, I could feel something. You know, men and women are not human beings. They are different polarities of what it is to be human. And that male energy is that, you know, knock your opponent down, put your foot on his throat and say, I can lick any goddamn son of a bitch in the world. That's that male energy, because it has to have a certain amount of ego to be able to face down a tiger with a spear. If you can't face down a tiger with a spear, your children get eaten. Okay? So there's a reason why we have that thing within us. And it was being destroyed. And I knew that if I fought back, I'd be destroyed. If I didn't fight back, I'd be destroyed. And something inside me cracked, just cracked. And I put my books down on the ground, and I walked out into the middle of Washington Boulevard, the major street in that area. And I stood on the middle of the double yellow line, and I looked at Rudy, and I said, come out here and do that. And he looked at me, and I looked at him, and he knew he was looking at death, because somehow he had pushed me to a place where I was outside social games. I didn't care anymore. I was going to kill him. I was going to push him in front of a truck, and I didn't care if I died doing it. And he blinked, and he never bothered me again. And I knew I had found something. I'd found a place that was outside the games, that was outside all of that hierarchical behavior. And I knew that I had to find it. I knew I had to learn what was that place. What was it to feel that calm, to be that unconcerned, to be, it's not that I was not afraid. It was the fear for the first time in my life did not matter. It was just an emotion. It wasn't, didn't mean anything about me. It didn't mean I was small or I was weak or that I shouldn't or I mustn't. It had the same significance as the wind blowing against my skin. It was just there. I had to find that. And the place where that knowledge is encoded is in the arts of war. And the civilian version of the arts of war are the martial arts, where they encode in the philosophies, in the physical movements, and the energetic exchanges, what it is to move beyond that. And what I will say is that these disciplines, and there are other transformative disciplines like yoga and various forms of meditation and so forth and so on. They're more concerned with what it is to be a human being. I was concerned specifically with what is it to be a man, because I was raised by my mother and my sister. And unless I could complete that circle, I couldn't be fully human. I understood what it was to be a human being of a kind, but only from the position of being gentle and thoughtful and nurturing. I didn't understand what it was to be able to look at somebody and say, I will kill you if you touch me or my children. And a man has to know that, or he can't step into that energetic. He can be human, but he can't be that. And most of what it is I have in my life, I have because I decided I wanted to be respected by the kinds of men I respected, and I wanted to be desired by the kinds of women I desired. And both of them demanded that I be able to fulfill my function in the world, not just as a human being, but as a man. Now, that was when I grew up. You're talking about 1960, 1962. Things are changing, and boys these days don't have the same demands on them that they did then. So I'm not saying this is something universal and eternal, but it was certainly true at the time. It was reinforced by both men and women. Both sides let me know in no uncertain terms, if I could not stand up to the Rudies of the world, I would not be considered a man.
And then from there, so do you immediately start searching out martial arts after that incident, or was it a few years later?
It was a few years later. I didn't start practicing them seriously until college. I did it a tiny bit in high school. I did wrestling when I was in junior college. But when I got to college, and between the time I finished high school and I got into college, I practiced some Korean martial arts. and actually competed in the National Korean Karate Championships in 1972 and took second place. But and then I went to college, and there was a guy named Pham Thai Thu, who was a Vietnamese kid who was teaching, who knew Taekwondo, who was a Taekwondo black belt, and I started a Taekwondo club on campus and studied with him. And I think that it was after that that I studied with C.O. Choi and went into the National Korean Karate Championships. I'm pretty sure that's the case there. It went on and on. And the arts as taught commercially do not have – I mean, I don't think anything has – anything available to the American public has the full picture of what it is. But you can piece it together. You can piece together the whole thing. And that's pretty much what I had to do. I had to learn the fighting over here and the philosophy over here and the health things over here, and then find people who had integrated these things as much as possible and ask them, what did you do? What are you doing? How are you doing what it is that you're doing? How is it that you can be the way you are in the world? So I looked for, you know, men who got that reaction from men and women, women who got that reaction from men and women. I found, you know, more men in that arena, but I knew some extraordinary women, and they gave me important pieces of the puzzle too. And some of the pieces came from totally outside, from studying Native American spiritual practices, or studying specifically, you know, becoming an apprentice of a very specific guru who had phenomenal physical abilities. I mean, he could lift — I know how this sounds, but it's the truth — he could lift over 7,000 pounds with one arm. And it's that thing of what is the human body capable of if you step outside of all your fear about it. There really are some extraordinary people out there, and I was blessed. Yes.
I'm just thinking the time that you're talking about, the time period — my brother is 13 years older than I am. Mm-hmm. And so that's when he was a teenager as well. And when that seems like that's when martial arts really exploded in America, as far as like Bruce Lee was. Yeah. First he was on the Green Hornet, and then, you know, his movies started to hit, and it just became something that kind of captured the attention of young teenage men, boys.
Yes. I mean, jiu-jitsu came first. You're talking, you know, the 30s, 40s, you know, and then judo came, and then karate came, but it was kung fu that really, really broke through. And Bruce Lee — no martial artist at the level of Bruce Lee had ever been in American media. He had the combination of star charisma and genuine ability, because he was well known in the martial arts community before he ever went on the Green Hornet. He was the real thing. And he was mind-blowing. People had not seen a human body do the kinds of things that Bruce Lee was doing. And so it touched that, you know, ooh, I want that. You know, that it's so spectacular. Grappling isn't as spectacular in the same way, okay? And karate, for all of its power, can look very, very stiff. And there wasn't anybody who was a TV star who was really good at karate. You know, there were some people who could kind of fake it. So, but Bruce Lee broke through. He really did create that image of possibility.
And that captured the attention of so many young men. My brother and all of his friends, you know, they didn't have any kind of real training. They just kind of watched, you know, black belt theater, and then went out in the yard and kind of started playing around with each other. But I also remember at the time that my mom couldn't keep a mop because my brother kept cutting them up and making nunchucks.
Well, that's that thing. I mean, both men and women, both boys and girls, want to be strong and have the capacity to be nurturing. But girls are encouraged specifically to nurture and sort of discouraged from being aggressive. Boys are discouraged from being nurturing and encouraged to be aggressive. So the situation is disadvantageous to beta males and alpha females. You know, it sucks for both sides. You know, I'm a constructed alpha. I know how to deal with alphas. In my heart, I never wanted anything to do with that game at all. All I wanted was to love people and heal and be gentle and and read poetry. And I was told in no uncertain terms that I would be treated like garbage if I could not stand up to the bullies. I mean, like I said, both the boys and the girls let me know in no uncertain terms. If I did not understand aggression, if I did not understand, if I could not be aggressive, or at the very least know how to deal with the aggressive guys, I'd get walked on by life. Hmm. And it was just, that message was very clear.
Now, you in talking about martial arts and Bruce Lee specifically, it reminded me of something I recently came across. I'm an elementary school teacher and I'm a musician. I teach music. And I've been reading a lot lately about this idea of deliberate practice. It's something that's been going on out there for, you know, in the literature for a while. Yeah. So it's 10,000 hours. Exactly. And it's this pushing ourselves to the limits. And I quote, it's probably, you probably know it because I think it's a pretty famous Bruce Lee quote, but it's, I don't fear a man who's practiced 10,000 different kicks. I fear the man who's practiced one kick 10,000 times.
And that's right. That's right.
And I want to know if you see any parallel between doing something like martial arts and your creative work as a writer of that flow experience.
It's all the same stuff. All the same thing. There is no difference. I'm not a martial artist. You know, I'm not a writer. I'm not a father. I am a being who – I'm water. I can pour myself into the container called martial arts. I can express myself that way. I can express myself with my children. I can express myself with my wife. I can express myself through words. I can express myself through storytelling. You know, but it all goes back to there are two core philosophical questions. Who am I and what is true? There are only two things that you can write about. What are human beings and what is the world that they experience? It's the same set of questions. In the martial arts, who am I? You know, I'm pushing myself. You know, I'm lifting weights. I'm practicing arm. I'm fighting or whatever. You know, who am I in that matter? I'm sparring with a kid lower than me, and he hits me in the face. Who am I? Do I have a flare of anger? Do I need to hurt that kid, or can I say, "Good shot, kid"? Be a little bit more careful with your control. You know, what is true? You know, is my body now the same as it was when I was 25? Of course not. You know, are there things I know now that I did not know then? Better. You know, so I can. You know, what about with my writing? Who am I? Am I willing to have the discipline? Am I willing? You know, there's something that I teach in my life writing course called The Machine, and it's a foolproof path to success in writing, and it's very simple. The first step is you write a sentence a day. Minimum, period. Second step is you write 1 to 4 stories a month. Third step is you submit those stories and you keep submitting them until they're sold. The fourth step is you don't rewrite those stories once you've submitted them except to editorial request. The fifth step is that you read 10 times as much as you write. And the sixth step is you repeat this process 100 times. That's the road, man. It's the road of trials in the hero's journey. And I could create a machine, a road like that for any discipline. And you will get better. How much better depends upon some natural things, where the doors of perception were when you began the path, what kind of mentors and guides you meet along the road. But that's what the hero's journey is. It's the path from one stage of performance in your life to another stage. And there is some magical combination of innate capacity and teaching and will and so forth. But Jerry Pournelle said to me a long time ago, he said, "Steve, once you learn to master anything, you know how to master anything else." It's true. The basic lessons which have to do with focused, honest work over time, passion, not only having a clear goal of what you want to do, but knowing why you want to do it. Why do you want to do this? Why are you – this could be the last day of your life. Why do you want to spend that day writing that book, writing that story, being with that person, doing that thing? Every day of your life is the last day of your life. When you get that, when you get that joke that you cannot live a life small enough that death will tiptoe past you and not notice you were there, you know, forget it. You know, the bad news is you're going to die. The good news is you have permission to make whatever you want of your life because you're going to die. It's the worst that can happen. It's already on the table, man. So armed with that question, how long am I going to be dead? Go out and live a wonderful life and love your kids and play with your dog and get really, really, really well laid as often as possible.
Well, it's so funny because I put all these questions together. The reason I wanted to get – I was telling Stephen before we started on the show, like I wanted to get him on because he's had such an amazing career. And, we're coming to the end of our time and we're going to have
– no!
Well, John, I was going to say, ask a question.
Yeah. No, it's – no. No, I want to add, you mentioned your life writing course and I did come across it and it seems like – a program that is, and I don't know how, if the information I saw on your website is, if that's the most current stuff, but for our listeners, many of our listeners are writers, are,
creatives.
Working creatives who are looking to get, look, so look, it seems like a great deal.
The way I talk is in alignment with your heart. And only you know that because this is the way I am from the time I wake up in the morning until I go to bed at night. If I seem like an asshole, you will not like me better if you get to know me better. But if you think, but if you think I'm an interesting guy, you'd like me better as you got to know me better. If you're in sync with my framework, then all I'm doing is I'm sharing in life writing what it is like to take the tools of writing, the hero's journey, your structure and characterization, and begin to apply them to the process of writing. And then to apply those same tools to your life, because mastery is getting the basics at unconscious competence. When you're using the hero's journey, for instance, not just to plan out your stories, but to plan out the process of writing your stories, what you have to do every day to get it done, the road of trials and the dark night of the soul and all that good stuff, but also to look at your life as a whole and the lives of the people around you, you're taking the shortest possible route to mastery that I know of. Because the hero's journey represents the collective wisdom of all the world's elders throughout all of time saying, this is the way life is going to be. That's all it is, man. And so the answer's been right in front of us. So life writing just takes that and takes it seriously and says, what if we take this seriously? And then collects all the different tools of self-development. And if you know that you're going to be crossing the Mojave Desert, and you can have somebody go out ahead of time and leave cans of water and food for you, okay, then the journey is easier. If you know ahead of time the kind of obstacles you're going to face when you're trying to achieve any goal, you can actually gather your resources before you hit the dark night of the soul. You know you cannot accomplish any goal of any worth without slamming into a wall, slamming into your limits, and generally speaking, becoming depressed and afraid. If you know that, before you start the path, then you can actually say, okay, at some point I'm going to be feeling in despair, alone and afraid. What I'm going to do is I'm going to write myself a letter. I'm going to sit down today and I'm going to write a letter and seal it and put it in a safe, and I will not open that letter until that day that I'm feeling alone, depressed and afraid. And then I open up that letter and it's a letter from past me to future me saying, we have been here before, buddy. This has happened over and over again. Trust it. Go to the movies, take a break, have some ice cream, hug your dog, make love to your wife, whatever it is. You can see I'm big on that. break your state. Have faith. Have whatever it is that you would wish somebody had said to you the last time you were in that depressive state. Life writing is about that. And so people who are interested in finding out more about that, they go to lifewrite.com and they'll find out everything they want and they can join for the first month for a buck. And they can cancel at any time. And I genuinely care about writers. I genuinely believe that every single human being has something to offer and that storytelling is what knits humanity together, saying this is how life looks from my position. This is how life looks from my position. When I was in Tanzania doing research for Great Sky Woman, one of my novels, and I just happened to have a copy of it sitting right here, I saw Maasai warriors herding their cattle, leaning one leg on their spears, talking into cell phones. And I knew at that moment the world was going to be fine. We're going to be fine. There will be ups and downs and sideways, and there are jokers in the deck. But we're going to be fine if we tell the truth, if we work hard, if we believe in our dreams, And if we just live every day as if it has importance in and of itself, but also remember that we might live a long, long time. That's all I've done, man. I've lived every day, and I've lived long enough that I've done a lot of really interesting and cool stuff.
Absolutely, absolutely. So once again, the new book is 12 Days,
yes.
Which is out June 27. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that, because that is the book that you have out right now.
30 years ago, I wrote a book called The Kundalini Equation, which was my take on what all this martial arts and transformative discipline stuff was. You know, I said, well, what if there is some truth at the core of it? In the intervening years, much to my surprise, a bunch of people came up to me and said, where did you learn those things? You know, and I said, well, I made a lot of it up, or I was researching. They said, come over here. Let me show you some stuff. And I have actually experienced some of the things that I was just theorizing about in that book because of the quality of people I was able to attract in my life. So some 30 years later, people have been asking me, well, whatever happened with this information about this advanced way of being? And I wondered what I could do that would be representative of that. It took me 3 years just to figure out how to plot 12 days because I wanted the plot to be very simple. And I wanted it to be very immediate. In some ways, it's a simple story of a woman trying to protect her family set against the backdrop of the apocalypse. But on the other hand, it's also about a warrior who was very damaged by things that happened to him and is on the verge of losing his honor. And he realizes that this woman who lives across the street from him has a terrible problem. And he and his friends who are getting ready to commit a robbery, which will cost them their honor, have one last chance at redemption if they can find what it is inside them to be heroes. So I got to play doing a lot of things that I liked doing and I love doing. And it's not for me to say how good it is. It's for me to say that I honestly gave it my best shot. And I hope people love it.
That's awesome. So again, 12 days out, June 27th. We're going to have Stephen back on because I'll just run through a couple of other things that he's done. He wrote a Star Wars book that I loved called The Cestus Deception. That was an Obi-Wan focused book. I loved that one. He's a screenwriter that's written for television, including The Outer Limits, Andromeda, and Stargate SG-1. So much cool stuff that
Don't
he's done.
Cry out loud.
Yes, exactly. So we'll have to have him back on, talk more about that.
But
thank you so much for sharing all of your insights and wisdom. It was a joy for me, and I think for Patrick too, and hopefully our listeners as well.
Honestly, this has been one of my favorite episodes so far this year.
This is
absolutely the top. Yeah.
Thank you. You guys are great. You know, you let me have a conversation about the stuff I actually care about. You know, your primary work of art is your life itself. Let me just leave you with that.
Well, the purpose of this podcast, the name, the Functional Nerds, is about, you know, what are you passionate about?
Yes.
What do you like to nerd about?
Man, I'm telling you, you know, tell your people, go to liferight.com. Try us out for 1 month. If you don't like what I'm giving you, I'll give you your dollar back personally. I believe in what we're doing just that much. I'm very aware of the fact that I'm going to die. I'm very aware of the fact that I'm closer to death than life. I have run out of all the bullshit I was born with. And all I want right now is to help as many people as possible the way my teachers helped me. I've had wonderful teachers.
And apparently also sex. So.
I studied sexual magic for 3 years. You have no idea at all. I have been bounced by experts, my friend. But the truth is that there isn't anything beyond simply putting all your cards on the table. This is who I am. Do I have time for one more story? Just one?
No, go for it, please.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. When I met my wife, Tanana Reeve Du, it was at a black science fiction writers conference, the African American Fantastic Imagination Conference at Clark Atlanta University back almost 20 years ago. And I treated her like a little sister at first because she was extraordinarily talented. I had a chance to read some of her first book. And I looked at this and I said, you know, wow, she's really, really talented. But she was also 14 years younger than me. So I just automatically, I was not thinking of her as a potential mate. But I thought of by being very protective as sort of a big brother. Then she got up and she told a story about how she got Stephen King to give her a cover blurb for her novel, My Soul to Keep. She was the relationship columnist for the Miami Herald, and Stephen King played in a rock band called the Rock Bottom Remainders with Dave Barry and a bunch of other things, a bunch of other guys, and they had a backup band, and they played at book fairs, and they're terrible and wonderful. You know, they really are. And Tananarive plays keyboards. And so she asked Barry, you know, said, I'd like to play keyboards with you guys. Well, it turned out their keyboard player was going to be taking the mic on some song or other, you know, so could you do keyboards during that? So she lied and said that she knew that song very well, went home, practiced. She looked great in a tight leather miniskirt, went up there, rocked the stage, caught Stephen King's eye, of course, at the after party, asked if she could send him a copy of her book. He said yes, he loved it. Factor back a quote. I sat in the audience listening to her say that, and I said, man, she did a three-wall bank shot on him. She used this position and this skill to get into this position, and she was ready and caught his attention, and bang, bang, bang. I said, man, she is really smart. And then almost as if noticing how smart she was gave me permission, I also said, and she's really cute too. I had not noticed, and I felt a chill go up my spine. I feel that same chill every time I tell that story. And I sat back, I said, oh, Steve, you're in trouble. I had never felt anything like that in my life. I lived in Washington State. She lived in Florida. We were both leaving the next day. I said, I have got to get her attention. I have got to get her attention. So I looked around. She came down off the stage, and she's signing autographs for all the people. And I looked around. I got to get her to – and there was a woman sitting in the front row with a baby in her lap. And I walked up to the woman, and I said, excuse me, ma'am, can I borrow your baby? And the woman said, what? And I said, no, I don't want to take him out of the room. I just really love kids, and I'd like to play with your baby a little bit. She said, okay. I took the baby, got down on the floor in front of Tananarive, and started playing with it. If I had not been sincere, if I had not been trying to communicate something, I love children. If you would look at me as a man and give me a chance, I swear that I would be the father of your children. I would protect them, nurture them, care for them. Just give me a chance. Look at me. That was the communication. If I had not honestly meant that, that would have been the dirtiest thing I'd ever done in my life, because there was no way a black professional woman in her 30s could look at an available black man who loved children without her hindbrain going, ding, 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 ding. Well, by the next day, we were committed to each other. We were in the airport at Atlanta holding hands, leaning our heads against each other, talking about how we could build an empire together. And she has been the love of my life since that moment. I have never turned back. What I said to her in my actions were 100% honest. Look at me. Give me a chance. We are trains passing in the night. We have a tiny window in which we might be able to see each other. And I was not going to let that pass.
That's amazing. That's
amazing.
Well, I can't think of a better way to end than that. So, Stephen, thank you again for your time today.
Pleasure.
Everyone listening, go check out Stephen's books. Go check out his life writing course. I think you'll dig them. All right, everybody. Patrick, anything you want to leave people with?
I got tears, dude.
Yeah, it's good. Well, everybody, thank you so much for joining us.
That's because you know it's the truth.
Yeah.
I love my wife with all my heart, and I only had a moment of time to try to let her know what I was, man. Just a moment. And thank God she gave me a chance.
Yeah.
She gave me a chance.
That is
and every
just
day, every day, every single morning, I thank God. I literally out loud while I'm doing Tai Chi will chant my thanks for the beautiful, brilliant woman in my life. Every single day.
Amazing.
That's the truth.
Yeah. That's awesome. Well, thank you so much, Stephen. Everyone listening, go
pleasure.
Check everything out that Stephen does.
Let's right, talk.
Yes, absolutely. All right, everybody.
Source for your people.
Yes. All right, everybody. Have a great week. We'll talk to you soon.
Elmo.
I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves, and I hope we pass the audition.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.
Would you like a chili, baby?
I'm the one in the middle.